Today's leaders face a situation no one imagined 50 years ago, getting 100 or more people to assemble complex and abstract ideas into invisible, effective decision-making machines. The key is focusing on people, not process. Agile software development is transforming how businesses run, but too many leaders are in the dark when it comes to how to captain agile teams. A hands-off approach won't work. Leaders must be active participants. To lead a team effectively means harnessing their intellectual power to successful and valuable results. It takes rigor, alignment, and efficiency. Today, my guest, Michael Levine, and I discuss how he got interested in leadership, especially within the agile space, his ideas of leadership for agile, three major frameworks for people-oriented agility, governments and the role of the organizational leader, and qualities of an agile leader. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Moving Forward Leadership Podcast, episode 103, People Over Process, with Michael K. Levine. Welcome one, welcome all to the Moving Forward Leadership Podcast. It's your Chief Leadership Officer, Scott McCarthy, and welcome to your podcast, Becoming a Better Leader. And that's to either becoming a better leader yourself, learning how to lead your teams better, or learning how to lead your organization better. And today we're going to be talking about teams specifically. All right. In talking about agility and leading agile teams, but a bit of organizational side and a bit of the personal side too, right? But nonetheless, agile, it's a hot topic today, and especially if you're in the software world where so many people are leading this day and age. You think about Google, you think about Apple, all these big corporations, right? There's a lot of software organizations out there and a lot of leadership within them. So this is why it's important. It's an important topic, and that's why it's on the show today. And it's one of the reasons why I have Michael on the show today. He's a leader in lean and agile thought. As a senior executive, he's driven results at Wells Fargo, US Bank, leading another leading software company. He has written well-received books on why do lean and agile and how to make organizational change to do so and how to lead for agility. They're both instructional and entertaining, but today we're going to talk about his book, People Over Process, Leadership for Agility, which is directly towards what we do here at Moving Forward Leadership. He's well qualified. He is a great guest to come on the show. Before we dive into today's episode, I got one thing to ask to you, the leader, the listener right now, is if this show does anything for you, if it helps you in any way, which I'm sure it does because you wouldn't be listening to it if it didn't. So if it helps you, I'm asking you right now one thing. Actually hit pause after I'm done talking. And I want you to hit pause and share either the show or an episode of the show with someone. Just one other person. That's all I'm asking. All I'm asking is for you to share the show with one other person who you think would either appreciate or that it could benefit. That's all. One other person. Okay, so when I say go, hit pause and do that. Ready? Go. All right, welcome back. Thanks for doing that. I truly appreciate you hitting pause and sharing the show with one other person. Anyway, that's it. I'm not going to hold you up any longer now. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my interview with Michael Levine discussing people over process and leading an agile organization. Michael, welcome to the Moving Forward Leadership Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to your listeners.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to know, first off, before we truly dive into it, is like, how did you get into agility? And more importantly, how did you get into diving into the leadership aspect of this style, per se?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think my first exposure to agility, I didn't know that I was doing agile. So I've been doing software for a long time. And, the whole evolution of agility in software, it started out when I first started, there really were no methods. It was really just a smart programmer talking to some business people and trying to code something up. And over time, it got more and more rigid as people developed methodologies to do it. It got to the point where people were talking about software factories and, computers writing software. And it became much more focused on the science of it as a process rather than as a creative element. And I just found that didn't work very well. And so I was doing agile things before it was agile. And I actually got into agile through lean. So I know you're into logistics, I think, and lean is came out of manufacturing.
Absolutely.
But in lean manufacturing, it's very focused on process standardization and continuous improvement. But I learned in lean product development that it's focused much more on teams and accountability and creative management. And I always had hard, big projects that were always new things. And so that really spoke to me. So when the Agile Manifesto came out in 2002, I liked a lot about it because I think it was a rejection of a lot of the previous very process-focused approaches to doing software. So I got into it very quickly and started exercising some of the techniques that came out of it. It was very successful, and my team really liked it. And then in about 2005 or 6, I was at Wells Fargo, and we were doing an enormous new software development project. And it was very driven by a consultant who wanted to follow a very standard methodology. And my team was already doing agile things. And the conflict between the two different approaches was pretty strong. And my team did really, really well, and the rest of the teams failed, and the project had to be canceled. And out of that, it was a big personal failure for me and a failure for my team. And, I really loved Wells Fargo and thought they had great people, and it was a really good idea. And it was kind of sad that the project failed. And that's what impelled me to write my first book. So I tried to write a book to explain to business leaders what agile software was about and lean software and why for complicated, difficult things, we really need to do that. So that's how I got into writing, and that's how I got into agile.
So your book is all about the people side of agile and agile business and how leaders can basically run businesses from an agile standpoint, but actually taking care of their people. So your first whole section is about leadership for agility. So what specifically from a leadership standpoint are you talking about here?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts there?
That's a really good question. So, different leaders are in different contexts of trying to execute on different missions. And the mission that I've been focused on in my career is large-scale new software. And throughout the past, 30 years I've been doing this, almost every major project we do is new. It's a new thing we're trying to do with new people who haven't worked together before, with new technology. And on the scale that I've worked, which has been Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, really big things, you need hundreds of people to do this. So the challenge is kind of a new thing for humankind, I think, which is how do you take dozens or 100 or more very smart, creative people, dealing with ideas, turning ideas into code. And unlike other kinds of idea-oriented things like a university, this code all has to work, and it all actually has to execute when you go to production. So it's not like building the pyramids or the Colosseum where you can see it as it goes. It's not like managing an army where, follow orders, which I know it's not that simple, but, it's managing a lot of people in a very highly trained thing. And, there's fairly repetitive skills, at least. I mean, every mission is different, and you have to train people to be agile in the military, too, I know. But this is about how you get very creative people doing new things in new ways with new people, with new tools to execute on something. And that challenge is where this leadership style, which I call leadership for agility, comes in. What kinds of behavior for people on teams and for organizational leaders can make this work? And I found that the way the principles that I've articulated has worked. And I think it is what we need. It's a way, you know, do you want me to describe kind of the basic idea of the leadership principles?
Absolutely. I'm going to ask that question. So let's dive in right in there. What are these principles? And I'm going to follow up right away before you even answer. And why are they different than any other, you know, generic leadership principles in the first place?
I think they're, let's start with what the principles are, and then we'll get to how different they are. Because I think you have a good point, which is, I think these leadership principles are valuable for lots of different things. And you can tell me what you think. There's three simple principles. One is rigor, which is make decisions based upon consideration of facts and options and make it visible. The next one is alignment, which is make sure that all your team is aligned, because what's going to happen is if you have rigorous good decisions and you can align around them, you can execute effectively. Because in this kind of environment, you have dozens or hundreds of people making independent decisions that are essentially not visible all the time. So you have to have them understand the basics of how you're going to work, or else you're going to get a lot of bad decisions that when you get to test, it's not going to work. And you can't see it very well as you're going along. And then the third one is efficiency. And efficiency is an idea that actually came out of Lean, which is about respect for people, which is don't waste people's time. And that's the simplest way of stating it. So rigor, alignment, and efficiency. And then the next question is, well, how do you make this happen? Well, there's leadership behavior for sure. But the other thing I think that's really important is what I call frameworks. And a framework is a number of simple tools that help people hang decisions on and help people communicate and align. And the ones I use as examples are the A3, which is the Toyota problem-solving mechanism, which you might be familiar with. Another one is at Amazon. They actually use a 2-to-6-page memo, and they start every meeting by having everyone read the memo. So there's a variety of those kinds of frameworks that can help people be rigorous, be aligned, and be efficient.
Yeah, I get what you're getting at. I guess my counter to what you're saying there is that, to me, alignment and rigor and respecting people's time, these are all, to me, just pure leadership principles, right? It doesn't matter if you're in an agile space or if you're in a, you know, logistics space, lean space, wherever, public service. It doesn't matter where you're at, where you're working. Like, as a good leader, you should be employing these principles anyway. So
I would agree with that.
But I guess what you're getting at, and what I get out of your book, though, is that these are ones that are probably more at the forefront in an agile organization.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that a couple of the things that are important is, because you have so many people making decisions in a way that's not visible, there has to be, that's where the alignment comes into place. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I think is really important, and one more kind of foundational idea here, is this difference between manufacturing and product development. So in manufacturing, like lean manufacturing, you basically standardize how you do something, you measure it, you continuously improve it, and you follow the process. In new product development, you can't do that because there's no process that you know that's going to work for these people because everything's new all the time. So there's some standard techniques that are valuable. And in software, knowing which is the crux of the matter. So is this now at the point where I can kind of build a software factory, where I can just take the next thing and deliver it, code it, test it, deploy it? Or, and if that's so, I do want to standardize it and measure it and continuously improve it. Or is it something that's a very creative a group, and the team has to figure out how they want to work? And they want to do that with expertise, and they want to do it with rigor, and they want to do it with efficiency, and they want to do it with alignment. So it's really knowing which one of those two things and what that right mix is. And so you can't just say, here's the cookbook to do it. There's a level above that, kind of a meta level of leadership, to help the team continually figure out how they want to work.
Yeah, I definitely like that whole point of there's no right way, right? there is a way. It's just not necessarily the same way it's going to work in every situation. And unfortunately, I find a lot of the leaders out there in whatever space kind of look for, well, what's the best solution here? Well, there isn't. You know, or what's the right cookie cutter solution? Well, there isn't one. Every situation is different. I can give you some advice. I can help you, you know, guide you. But ultimately, the people are different. The scenario is different. It doesn't matter because everything is different and you have to look at it in that context.
Right. So you really want to get everyone's head in the game. So you have to give people enough information to participate effectively. You have to help them interact by using these frameworks. You have to emphasize rigor so that people just don't lapse into you know, how they've always it or what
you're
they
busy.
Might suspect might
you're
work.
Busy taking care of your people. You're
and
busy taking care of
because you need the alignment efficiency.
If you're a
you
small business owner
visible.
And you're at the top of the
because
food chain,
you
you're here listening to this podcast because you
people
want
doing
to
things efficiently that
know
are wrong.
How to lead your people better.
Right.
So you don't have time for
so
this.
So how do you go about
details
you know,
that revolve around marketing?
Physically doing these things.
I get
keeping
it.
People
I'm with you.
Keeping
side by side. So that's why, you know what? I've tapped into
I think these frameworks.
If you look
really
around
helpful.
At all my social
so,
media,
well, you know,
banners,
one of my
and logos,
frameworks
they're all
the developed
by Penji. Jonathan Grzybowski, co-founder of Penji, has been a great supporter of the podcast, and I'm supporting him.
It follows
so if you go
the,
to Penji.
The lean ideas of problem solving, so it starts with, you know, what's the problem?
Use the coupon code MFL15.
What are my options? What's
you're going
to get 15%
off your monthly subscription. And that isn't just
one page document.
That is
that
for
you start by
life.
Defining what the problem or opportunity is.
Into them, you're going to get that
15% and then you describe the current
off,
state.
Huge.
And where
check
going.
It out.
And you try
and
to do it
in
as much
right
pictures
you.
As you can.
Because you know what? I know
and
the
it's
right
not
way.
About the document.
AM,
it's about the process of creating and socializing.
Co.
So
use the coupon code.
Typically what we would do is
MFL
if you have a particular
15.
Problem, we would write up one of these one-pagers and we'd start with the first box, which is what is the problem? And when you write up that one box, you socialize it with the people you need to socialize it, who need to agree that that is indeed the problem or the opportunity, and that it's worth spending the effort on to go on. So you build the alignment and the around that, that is a problem, let's go deal with it. And then the next thing you do is you identify what the current state is and some options, and you want to kind of stop there and make sure that people are aligned around that. So you want to bring people along as you go. So what you're doing is you have rigor and you have efficiency from the tool that people are used to and you have alignment by sharing it. And then you continue on until you're completed and agreed. That's a way of kicking off an initiative. It's the way of dealing with a problem. It's a way of dealing with an opportunity. And it works. Another thing I would coach people on is in that kind of situation where you're dealing with a problem, you know, when I was younger, I thought leadership was about figuring out what the problem is, figuring out what the answer is, and getting people to do it. you'd think about the substance of the problem first. And in these kind of situations where the problems are complicated and no one person knows the answer, and you have to have a bunch of people aligned to execute on the solution, you have to think about who are the people first. So it's like what people need to be engaged in this in what way before you actually think about the solution to the problem.
No, I definitely I like that whole idea, whole ideology. Sorry, you know, framing out the problem first is definitely crucial before you start jumping into looking for solutions, right? And on top of that, making sure you got the right players in play, and making sure you have the right people in play around the table to look at that problem from every possible angle or every right possible angle is crucial. To ensure that you get the right solution set brought out. So you talked about the one pager from Toyota.
Yeah.
You have three major frameworks in your book. You talk about architecture, the plan, and team structure.
Yes.
So does that fall into one of those, or is that just something, you know, overlaid with it?
I think those are typical progressions of complicated software projects.
Okay.
So the first one. And they also are examples of frameworks that bring rigor, efficiency, and alignment. So the first one is the architecture simulation, which is something actually one of my teams made up 20 years ago, and we've been doing ever since. And it's a way of taking the technology architecture and the associated business process flows and bringing them together.
Mm-hmm.
Because what typically happens in projects is you'll have technical architects build the architecture, you'll have business people build the business process, And it's possible that either one will get done well, but the probability, if you don't explicitly address it, that they'll get done both well together, that the architecture supports the business process and the business process supports the architecture, is low. So what this, in the book, I describe what this mechanism is, what this framework is, and then show it in action in a company I made up called Pacifica Bank, and shows the techniques and how it works. And the basic idea with it is you simulate transaction flows through the technical architecture, but you do it in a very structured meeting that's highly visible. So, you know, some of the rules are things like no projection. You know, you can't just build a Visio and project it on the wall. You actually have to use construction paper and masking tape. No tables to sit at. You have to sit at chairs or stand up around the wall. So it's a way of getting people engaged and working together in an efficient way to get alignment around this combination of things that you have to have as the foundation for your software project.
You're a leader. You're busy. You're busy taking care of your people. You're busy taking care of your organization. And if you're a small business owner and you're at the top of the food chain, you're here listening to this podcast because you want to know how to lead your people better. So you don't have time for that nitty-gritty details that revolve around marketing. Believe me, I get it. I'm with you side by side. So that's why, you know what? I've tapped into using Penji. If you look around at all my social media banners and logos, they're all developed by Penji. Jonathan Grzybowski, co-founder of Penji, has been a great supporter of the podcast, and I'm supporting him. So if you go to penji.co, P-E-N-J-I.co, and use the coupon code MFL15, you're going to get 15% off your monthly subscription. And that isn't just 1 month. No, that is for life. As long as you're paying into them, you're going to get that 15% off, which is huge. Check it out and see if Penji is right for you. Because you know what? I know they're right for me. Again, that is Penji, PENJI.co, and use the coupon code MFL15. And now, time to get back to the show. That's interesting. The whole no projection, people around standing or at chairs, no tables. What's the whole reasoning behind it? You kind of hinted at it, I believe, but is there a deeper reason behind that?
No, I don't know the science of it. I just know the reality of it, which is people don't interact well with technology.
Right.
Especially not with each other. So I remember a time in this big failed project at Wells Fargo where we were looking at the technology architecture. My team was doing this visible thing up on the wall, combining business process and technology architecture together. Another team had just had their technology architects build Visio diagrams of the whole thing. So they tried to share it with the business line, and they basically project up on this wall this diagram that no one could make any sense of. And the difference between the two is so dramatic. One sucks people in, one pushes people away.
Got it. Yeah, I actually can see that. And it's part of the buying in process, right? Because as people physically work through things, then they start understanding it in a deeper level, right?
That's how people learn, right? And people need to participate. They can't just be lectured to learn effectively.
Hmm. Makes sense. Okay, so we just talked about the architecture. Now let's get into the plan and team structure.
Yeah, so the planning is for most of the projects that I do, and the one that's in the book, it's a complicated project that includes several different teams. So the project in the book, there's a web system, like the front end on the internet or mobile. There is a line of business system that does calculations based upon foreign currency hedging, is the example I made up. And then there's four or five other teams that are involved in it. And all of them have a part to play. And so in the book, these people all go through the architecture simulation together so they understand what we're building and why and how it's supposed to work. So they have that foundation of what they're doing and why they're doing it and what the pieces are and how they interact. Then they need to figure out, what do I have to do? When do I do it? What am I dependent upon? So in the framework that I present there is a project planning meeting where you have, again, on the wall, a timeline that goes from now to the end. Leadership provides some desired dates. So like, here's when we think we want to go live. Here's when we think we'd probably need to go into, you know, formal end-to-end testing, and four or five other dates to just provide a framework for people to work within. And then each team splits apart and does, here's the things that I need to do for my team, and here's when I think I can do them based upon those high-level dates. And then one by one, the teams go up to the wall and put their little yellow stickies on the wall saying, here's where I think my dates are and what my tasks are, while everyone else is standing around looking at it and kibitzing. So they'd say, okay, if you have that done here, I think I was going to be done with this here, and I'm dependent upon you. So they move the stickies around. And so that process of interacting with people and doing it with stickies and walls and sub teams coming together into larger teams, really works. And you wind up at the end of the, at the end of that with a project plan that is rigorous because we considered all of the interactions, and it was aligned because everyone's participating, and it was really efficient. You got done in one or two days, something that, you know, It could in most projects, it might never get done.
The interesting thing I find here is probably the role of the leader in all this. And I feel like the role of the leader here, it, obviously, if you're in charge of the team, the overarching team, is not necessarily the leader as in the one that's giving direction and orders and guidance on this stuff. Well, yes, they're giving guidance at the beginning. However, they're more orchestrating.
Yes.
Right, kind of orchestrating, allowing the delegating, allowing the teams to go out, the sub teams to go, do what they need to do, figure out what they need to do, and bring it all in and orchestrating, and then synchronizing so that every in the end, so everything flows and you get the end state that you want.
Yeah, and I call it facilitating, which is orchestrating, is very the same, pretty much the same word here, and the style of leadership is called facilitative leadership when I learned it. And I think that's exactly right. And that's a transition that I went through as a personal leader, you know, when I was younger and learned this. As I said, I used to think the role of the leader was to figure things out and then get people to do it. And as I learned more, I realized that if I have to tell everyone what to do, it's all on me. Right? And the probability that I can figure things out becomes lower and lower as systems get more and more complicated. So this is the style of leadership of getting the input and the alignment. Is how do you get everyone's head in the game early on? How do you get them to align with each other? And then how do you give them a plan that they can all execute together? So, I mean, I love this kind of work. It's where no one really knows the answer. No one really knows how to go about it. And the job of leadership is to make this all happen. And then to make it happen over and over again. So one person in one environment can make it happen for one project if they got enough, you know, charisma or power or whatever. But how do you get an organization to do this over and over and over and build it into the culture? I think that's the even more interesting question.
That is a definitely more interesting question and a very difficult question to even go looking for the answer, to start looking for the answer, let alone find the answer.
And you've seen companies do it. So Toyota was famous. Doing this with their lean product development and lean manufacturing, you know, for, you know, this is 20 years ago or so, but Toyota was so much by far the best car manufacturer in the world that wasn't close, and it was all because of their culture. Amazon today is, you know, winning pretty much everything, and part of that is their culture and their focus on this narrative storytelling and memos. So you can build a culture of this over time. It takes leadership, and then the leadership need to spread that and build believers all around to support that way of working.
Culture is definitely something we spend a lot of time discussing here at Moving Forward Leadership. Different experts on all kinds of different culture development, culture, you know, fixing, I guess, is probably not the best word out there, but the one I can think of right now, fixing broken culture, you know, getting rid of negative culture. We spend a lot of time discussing culture here for the listener. This culture is such an important part of leadership and organizational theory and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, moving forward, we've talked about the architecture. We talked about the planning process. Now, you go into team structure as well. obviously the structure, yeah, you know, it's always important what your team, how your team is structured, what it consists of. So I'd like to get your standpoint and your viewpoint on that.
So most of the work in software is done on teams, and there's been a lot of evolution of what those teams need to be. Ideally, we want to have teams of, you know, 10 or so people focused on business deliverables and able to have all of the things they need to deliver. So ideally, you have teams that are self-contained and can execute. And that is possible if you're lucky and you're starting from scratch or you're able to arrange your technology to work that way. Most of us don't have that luxury. So in the environments that I've been in and the environment that I show in the book, the teams are actually arranged according to things like systems or companies or departments. So you have, in the example in the book, one of the groups is a vendor, and they have their own culture and their own teams, and they have to participate. Then the website, they build all the web software. They have their own approach. You have another system. You have the testing team, which happens to be separate in this organization, which isn't always the case. And so each of those teams are going to be working together in that functional way. And then you have to bring them together to work across the groups. And I think that's what this team structuring question is what are the units of the teams? How do those teams get led? How do those teams then interact with each other? So the model I present is I call silos and bridges. And so you want to build the right silos that the teams are as autonomous as they can be. And then they have to have the right bridges to their partner teams. So if you're the test team and you want to be organized as the test team, you have to have bridges to every one of the development teams so that you know what's coming and you're working together and you deal with the defects in the right way. And then you're all working together with all the other teams with the high level plan of when's the code going to be done and how do you deal with the problems and finance and compliance and risk. All of these teams coming together. So I frame it as what are the right silos and then what are the right bridges between the silos at the team level. And that's just at the team level. Then you get into governance. So how do you connect this team of teams to the larger organization? Okay, because in larger organizations, teams don't live by themselves. They have to be connected to all kinds of other things outside of that particular team.
I like that whole idea of methodology, the bridges and silos ones, because teams do need some sort of protection to work in, you know, independently, right? And focus on what they're supposed to be focused on. But at the same time, working in isolation equals death. And we know that, right? Especially you on the software world. You can't have the back end type people working the back end of a program not coordinating with people who are working, you know, the user interface. It doesn't work in the end.
And then everyone can't communicate with everyone else. That's way too much overhead. So you have to limit the communication to the right things.
Right.
And so how do you explicitly create the right connections in the right silos?
Yeah. And that's definitely a difficult task, I would say, for a leader. And knowing where those right connections are. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it's not even necessarily, the leader of the sub-team may not even be the right connection. It might be a person, you know, a person who's just a member of the team, who's the right person to interact with another member of another team who may not even be that team lead.
Yeah. And there's been, there's been attempts in software as, you know, people have scaled agility. I think that something started at Spotify is pretty famous, mm-hmm. where they came up with this idea of tribes and squads and chapters and guilds. It's the same idea, small teams working together, and then kind of the experts in the various roles across the teams working together as a community. Like all the testers might have a testing community of practice. So you build the right connections across the teams while leaving the teams as focused on delivering what they need to do as they can. And then you have to deal with what you're given as well. So, and again, like my other example of the project planning, as a leader, you might not know the right structure. So I'm going into a meeting next week where I'm not quite sure what the right structure is. I don't know enough about it to say. So we're going to go through kind of the architecture discussion and then kind of put the teams together. I'm not sure what the answer is going to be. All I know is I have to help this team make the decisions around what should our structure be.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. I want to go back to the governance thing, though, because we kind of skimmed over it.
Okay.
So what do you mean exactly by that governance piece? Yeah. And where does the leader fit into it?
Yeah. So I have a whole chapter on what I call the obligations of organizational leaders. So in Agile, as it came out in the Agile Manifesto, is, I would call it, actively hostile to organizational leadership. So I think the model of organizational leaders is like that pointy-haired guy in Dilbert, right? Guys who don't have much value, who don't know what they're doing. And, I mean, I've been lucky that I haven't found that to be the case in my career. And might just be because I've always been an organizational leader. But the leader has certain obligations. And the obligations include things like helping form the right teams. It includes things like helping select and reinforce the right frameworks. It includes things like dealing with performance problems on teams. Because a team, if someone isn't performing on it, it's hard for a team of peers to deal with someone who's not performing. Also, there's things like money that managers control. There's things like taking big risks that managers need to, socialize beyond the team. And then there's something that I think is really important that doesn't get much press, because we really want to empower our teams. But there are times when teams need leaders, organizational leaders, to make a decision. So one of the best examples I give is a project that's been going on for a long time, that's not going very well, doesn't look very good. The team will just keep working it forever. At some point, an organizational leader has to say, I think it's time to stop.
Yeah.
Teams might come up with that. They might not. But sometimes they need help from an organizational leader to say, stop this.
Yeah, organizational leader definitely needs to have that larger picture, right? And be able to make those tough decisions when the time comes.
Yeah, one other thing I'd mention in the role of the organizational leader is, on a team you might have people from several different disciplines who report to different people. And so one of the cases that is in the book and is very similar to something I did myself was a team of people inside one company working with people inside another company. And they work together on an integrated team where they're delivering something for one of the companies and it's a product for the other company. Okay, and that's a pretty common model in our industry and lots of industries. But how that team works together, they need the help of their respective managers. And so in the book, I have one of the leaders of the bank and the leader of the software company they're dealing with have a regular weekly half-hour touch base. Now, they both would gather information from their team, so they kind of know where things are at, and they would chat about it just to develop a relationship. And then when things got difficult, which they often do, they've established a personal relationship. They spend some time with each other. They can help their team. And I don't see how that happens without that kind of role of organizational leaders.
No, it definitely, it's definitely required for sure. One of the things we talked about, one of the things that we haven't really talked about, and I haven't really noticed it in your book, is qualities of an agile leader. And no doubt with your experience and your research and everything that you've done, you have some ideas of what those qualities are. So for you, what are some of the most important qualities for a person to possess to be a truly effective agile leader?
That's a great question. And I think you might be surprised by my answer. So I think leaders are created, not born. And I think a wide variety of personality types and skill sets can be really good leaders. And they'll do it in different ways. Right? So there are great agile leaders who are very people oriented, that aren't very strongly technical, that are risk averse and don't like conflict, and they can still be a really great leader. There are agile leaders who are brilliant technologists who are really driven, and they can be a good agile leader. And I think a lot of it comes down to learning the skills. And I go back to my three principles. So are you fostering rigor? Okay. So, and that's a behavior thing. So if someone comes to you with, here's a problem, here's a solution, you have to say, show me your work. What are your options? That's great leadership. Okay. And you can do that in a variety of ways. And then we teach things like how to give feedback. You know, first say what's good, yeah, and then go into how you could do it better. Things like thinking about the people first. You know, I talked a little bit about if you're confronted with a problem, and even if you know the answer, you still have to figure out who else needs to know that answer because you're not going to execute on that. So I go back to those three principles of rigor and efficiency and alignment, and that's what great agile leaders need to have. And they can do it in quite a wide variety of ways.
No, I really like that. And the fact is, I'll probably surprise you by saying I fully agree with your first statement.
Oh, good.
Okay. Because I wouldn't do what I did if I didn't, right?
Right.
There's leadership skills in everybody as far as I'm concerned. But everybody has a different style and not everybody's meant to be the perfect leader for every situation or every organization. Absolutely. Right? So my style may not work in an agile space.
But it might not.
But it seems to work in a military space.
Well, and this goes back to kind of the space of what in my world we're trying to do with large scale software, especially business software, which has such big process implications for so many people, where it's a very intellectual game. So you have to be facile with concepts. You have to be open to being challenged. You have to be willing to show your work. You have to be willing to work with others. And you have to be willing to respect other people. If you have those basic qualities, the rest can be learned.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Michael, man, we're actually bumping up on time already. It's crazy.
Wow.
To think about it. But before we shut down here, I do got a last couple questions for you. And the first one is one I ask all my guests, and that is, according to you, Michael Levine, what makes a great leader?
What makes a great leader? I'm just thinking back to the great leaders that I've known, and I would say there's certainly a vision thing. Of being able to articulate a direction and have buy-in. And I don't think it's all just your own vision. It has to be encapsulating or distilling a common vision that people buy into. That's a really big part of it. Another part of it is attracting loyalty and respect from other great leaders. I would say that's really critical. And then I think honesty and integrity.
Awesome. Couldn't agree with that anymore. So the final thing is, as always, feel free to give yourself a shameless plug. Where can people find you? Where can they find the book, People Over Process, Leadership for Agility? And yeah, let us know where we can follow you.
Sure. My website is called thetalesofagility.com. It kind of explains the why we do Agile and what it is, how to make organizational change. And then this last book is about the people over process. And then my books are all on Amazon, People Over Process, Michael K. Levine. And that's how you would see it.
Awesome. For the audience, is always easy. It's easy for you guys. Just go to movingforwardleadership.com/103103. And all links are in the show notes there. Michael, again, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule for coming out, talking to the listener, all about people over process and agility. And yeah, thanks for coming out and thanks for a copy of the book too. Truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, that's all I got for you fine folks today. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed the interview. And most importantly, I hope you got something out of it. And if you did, remember, R squared, S squared, right? write and review the show so that it gets a little bit noticed a bit more. But most importantly, I can help more people, because that's what I'm here for. That's what my guests are here for, is to help more people become better leaders and not being bosses, right? So remember that. R squared, rate and review. S, share the show. Share the show with someone who you think can relate to the podcast as a whole and today's topic. And then finally, subscribe. Subscribe so that you never miss another episode. And you can do that via your podcast playing app of choice through movingforwardleadership.com/subscribe. That's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. And as always, stop bossing and start leading. Take care now.